Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
Audrey, how does an octopus go to war?
Funny you should ask, Aaron. It goes to war well armed.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win this week's dinner parties.
You just got a joke of sorts from Aaron Aitz and Audrey Yule, co-directors of the new documentary 99%, the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film. That'll help break the ice.
Pithy title.
Yeah, we'll speak with them later. Also, we'll hear from award-winning author Jonathan Lethem. His novel Dissident Gardens came out this week.
Plus, Frida Kelly, former secretary of the Beatles, tells us why she stepped off the Magical Mystery Tour. Mm. Bon Appetit magazine's Andrew Knowlton drinks Nebuchadnezzar's. And Miss Manners herself tells you how to avoid hanging out with your coworkers.
Essential. But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
President Obama said the U.S. is prepared to hold off on military action against Syria.
Swimmer Diana Nyad has officially defended herself over accusations that she cheated.
Apple had one of its big unveils. It's a new iPhone. Or should I say iPhones?
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Rehan Harmansi. She is deputy editor at Modern Farmer. That is a new food and culture magazine. And Rehan, what story are you going to be talking about at your dinner parties this weekend?
Well, I'm going to be talking about this future of space farming.
Wait, that would assume that it has a present.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, there's a present and future of space farming.
Is this literally farming in space?
Well, it actually is. You know, there's a lot of private space ventures these days. A lot of them have farm components, but NASA is launching its first vegetable growing experiments later this year. They're going to go to the International Space Station. It's time for astronauts to grow, you know, have some locally grown food.
Now Martians don't have to import their food from Earth.
Oh, man. Great.
Yeah, I mean, the carbon miles on that are ridiculous.
That's true.
So wait a second. Haven't they been experimenting with food up in space for a while? Isn't that where Tang came from?
Well, they have, but they haven't actually grown food for humans to consume in space.
I see. So this is the first time that astronauts will be able to feed themselves off the food they're growing on spaceships.
That is the hope, yes.
Don't they have enough to do up there? They have to send messages back home. They have to dance and play golf.
Now they got
to
plant beans.
I mean, this just seems like an extra chore. Yeah.
It's funny you mention that because while, you know, NASA is obviously very invested in the farm to table movement, the growth of vegetables in space has as much to do with the mental health of astronauts as the nutritional benefits.
Interesting.
It gives them something to do, basically.
Particularly when you're in space, there's not that much to do, and watching something grow is extremely emotionally fulfilling.
Oh. Well, now when I look at the Little Dipper, I'll just picture a backhoe digging up space to plant kale.
Yeah,
Little backhoe.
Rehan Harmansi, thanks so much for the small talk.
Thank you, guys.
And now, time for cocktails. Once again, we tell you something that happened this week in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's our rarely imitated history lesson with booze.
First, the history part. 52 years ago this week, the U.S. government decided to stop complaining about the weather and actually do something about it.
Michelle Phillippe tells us how that went.
In 1945, America conquered fascism. A year later, we took aim at a new enemy, hurricanes. It started with Project Cirrus, in which the military, encouraged by scientists at General Electric, flew a plane out to sea over a hurricane and dropped dry ice into the clouds. The idea? To freeze the water inside, weakening the hurricane. That didn't happen. But coincidentally, the storm did suddenly change course and charged straight into the state of Georgia, doing millions of bucks worth of damage. Georgians threatened lawsuits, saying the government had turned the twister toward them. It hadn't, but Project Cirrus was canceled anyway. In September 1961, though, we tried again, this time bombing a hurricane called Esther with silver iodide. It seemed to weaken the storm's winds by 10%. So the next year, the government officially launched a, quote, hurricane modification program. They called it Project Storm Fury. Over the next decade, Storm Fury planes, armed with special silver iodide-stuffed rockets, took aim at a few storms, but they only seemed to weaken two. And eventually, scientists learn, those probably weakened naturally. The flights ended in 1971. Still, Storm Fury wasn't a total waste of taxpayer dollars. It provided data we still use today to predict hurricane behavior. Plus, it freaked out our enemies. Fidel Castro later claimed Storm Fury was a plot to launch hurricanes at Cuba.
So that was the history. Now for the drink to go along with it, we're talking to Andrew Volk, co-owner and head bartender at the Portland Hunt and Alpine Club. Maine is where in 1961 Hurricane Esther eventually landed and dissipated. This was the hurricane that led to Project Storm Fury. Andrew, what drink does this story inspire you to make?
You know, I love the name Project Storm Fury, and I want to name a drink Storm Fury.
It is a cool name. It sounds like a war, which I guess in a way it was.
Yep. So the Storm Fury, they seeded the clouds with iodine. And when it comes to drinking iodine, the first thing that a bartender would think of is an Islay scotch.
Really?
The nose, the smell, it's a scotch that's a peated scotch, and the smoked peat gives a little bit of iodine nose to it, a smell.
So you're going to seed your drink with this scotch.
That's exactly right. And so I'm going to start with kind of a twist on a classic hurricane drink. The hurricane being, you know, a great classic New Orleans drink, actually. 3/4 ounce of light rum.
Okay.
3/4 ounce dark rum. 3/4 ounce lime juice. And 3/4 ounce raspberry syrup. You shake it in a shaking tin and strain it over fresh ice.
Okay.
And then you float, you know, a teaspoon or maybe a tablespoon of Lafroig scotch on the top of the drink. Gives it this nice iodine smell to it in a very good way.
I think you're the first person that ever said it puts a nice iodide smell on top of it.
You know, it adds a smoky element to it without overpowering kind of the citrus beach side of the drink.
All right, so what you're saying is that this lacing with iodide actually works, unlike the Project Storm Fury.
That's exactly right, yes.
All right, and as a bar owner, do you prefer stormy weather or not? Does that pack your bar, or does it have the opposite effect?
You know, it depends on the night. If it's just stormy enough, we can be packed. If it's too stormy, people tend to stay away.
Ah, fair weather customers.
Yep. For me, you know, weather certainly dictates what you're drinking, but you can have a good drink on a sunny day, and you can have a good drink on a real crummy day, too.
I thank you. Help me through the storm.
Enrico, after that interview, something didn't seem quite right.
Mm-hmm.
So I re-listened to the history, and of course, the government seeded clouds with silver iodide, not iodine.
Yes. Yep.
But good news, it turns out iodine is a component of silver iodide. So the drink still keeps with the theme.
Because, you know, the last thing you want is a scientifically inaccurate cocktail. That's no good.
A drink based on the hurricane demands precision.
Indeed. In fact, actually, here are the precise coordinates for our website, dinnerpartydownload.org. You will find all our recipes there.
Oh, oh baby.
And now, the guest list, in which an interesting person or persons lists some interesting things.
And today, our guests are Audrey Yule and Aaron Eitz. They made the acclaimed documentary Until the Light Takes Us about Norway's controversial black metal music scene. In their new film, they examine the Occupy movement with the help of several hundred friends. Here they are to explain and share their list.
Hi, I'm Aaron Eitz.
And I'm Audrey Yule, and we are the founders and director of producers behind 99%, the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film. Essentially, when we decided to make this film, we thought it would be interesting to try and mirror the Occupy movement's own processes to sort of test them at the same time. We weren't part of the movement, but we saw them, you know, everybody was welcome and they had this consensus process. And so we put out word to just anybody around the country who wanted to be part of this film could be a part of it.
And they were sort of built into a little army in different regions to go out and film this large sweeping movement. It's a pretty experimental way to create a film. I'm not sure it's been done before, so we thought we would give you a list of 3 experimental films, ones that you don't have to be scared of. They're not going to warp your mind, but they will give you a new way of looking
at it. They might warp your mind a little bit, but in a good way.
Number one would be Superstar by Todd Haynes, a film that tells of the life and death of Karen Carpenter, the great 70s pop singer who was one half of the Carpenters. And it's done so using Barbie dolls and shoebox sets built to scale. It's almost narrative, but the use of Barbie dolls gives it a very different feeling.
I mean, he was actually like whittling away the Barbie's face as she was suffering from the effects of anorexia. So it's a pretty starkly fascinating telling of a story using Barbie dolls.
You don't eat. I really think this diet of yours is the problem. I mean, Karen, you look really thin.
I like the way I look.
It's kind of a tough subject. You know, this is not a comedy by any means.
But in some ways, I feel like a doll treatment might be less harrowing and more friendly to someone watching it who really wants to know the story than actually seeing that acted out on the screen.
It's kind of amazing. And actually, something that I love about it is that you actually cannot access this film without looking for it. It was pulled. The Carpenter family sued and had it pulled because of licensing issues.
It's always a thrill when you have to seek out something and then you eventually get it. And it's fantastic.
Another filmmaker that I love who works in experimental is Chris Marker. I'm going to choose from him La Jetée, which was later made into Terry Gilliam's film 12 Monkeys. It's a short film. It was made almost entirely using still photographs. It's a really fascinating story that involves time travel. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's about the way that a person's death can mark their life. I've probably said too much already.
It's an exceedingly lyrical film where one moment of motion footage of a woman opening her eyes has the impact of a nuclear bomb.
Oh, that's good.
Our third film is Ross McElwain's Sherman's March, which is ostensibly about Sherman's Civil War march through the South, but McElwain suffered a traumatic breakup with his girlfriend before filming and had a hard time leaving that behind.
So as he's going on this journey through the South, following Sherman's actual march, he's also running into all of his ex-girlfriends and trying to figure out from them just what went wrong. And it's hilarious.
You think of anything of it really has anything to do with your lifestyle, like you're talking about, the way you dress, the way you live? I think you should tidy up a little bit. You can look kind of neat and pleasing to the eye, artistically.
And occasionally he'll say, and by the way, Sherman came through here. It's only tangentially about Sherman's March. It's more about love.
I think I actually saw for the first time when I was, I'd been seeing somebody and we were breaking up. But it wasn't long after that that Aaron and I actually met and we are a couple. So Sherman's March might have been a cautionary tale for what could go wrong if I didn't do this one right.
Yeah, what could go wrong if you allow yourself to be on camera when you're making films?
The guest list from Audrey Yule and Aaron Ates. Their movie 99%, the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film, is in theaters now and airs on the Pivot Channel Tuesday.
All right, coming up, we meet the woman who kept the Beatles on schedule. And Bon Appetit food critic Andrew Knowlton says bathrooms are the new black.
When the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. Coming up, the real Miss Manners tells you about some manners you may be missing.
Perfect.
And a man who spent half the year eating in the best restaurants in the country tells us what he discovered.
Tums.
Big bottles of Tums. No, not really.
Something like that. But first, ladies and gentlemen, this show is all about great dinner party conversation. But we've got a guest now with a trove of the best dinner party anecdotes ever who didn't share them with anyone for decades. Her name is Frida Kelly, and for 11 years, she was the secretary for the Beatles.
The famous Ruddles cover band.
The very ones. She was with them basically for their entire career. Her life is the subject of a new documentary called Good Old Frida. It's on screen in Los Angeles, New York, and on iTunes. This week, I spoke to Frida and the film's director, Ryan White. He started by telling me how he met his subject.
I've actually known Frida for my whole life. My uncle is Billy Kinsley. He was in a band called the Mersey Beats. So I grew up going back and forth to Liverpool my whole life, and Frida was in my uncle's group of friends. I did not know she was the Beatles secretary. As we explore in the film, she really has lived a life of anonymity and is that private, and so it just never came up until a few years ago when she approached me about doing a little DVD, as she calls it, for her family, and just a family film.
Too late, Frida. It's out now. Why
Found out about me.
I'm afraid so. Why did you keep mum for so long?
Because I wanted to. I'd worked for them for so long, and then I just wanted to get on with my married life and have children and look after my husband and do the shopping and everything. I mean, I was approached over the years.
Really? You know,
yeah. About 6 people approached me to do a book, but I didn't want to do one.
I have to admit, when I first heard about this movie, the first thing that just came to mind was, oh man, they'll do a movie about anything having to do with the Beatles now. But this is really an extraordinary story. At what point did you, Ryan, realize that this was just not going to be a run-of-the-mill Beatles tale?
Well, I never wanted to tell a Beatles tale. When I was originally approached by Frida, I thought I was more doing her a favor for her family, recording her stories from their family members. And once we began having the conversations, my mind was just blown. And not just as a Beatles fan, because I'm not a huge Beatles junkie. I'm a big fan of Beatles music.
And you get to make this movie? That's not fair.
I know. Well, I'm the only documentary filmmaker in the family, so I lucked out. But she's an amazing storyteller, and that's what I'm drawn to as a filmmaker.
Well, let's hear some of those stories. I don't want to blow the entire movie for people.
Oh, no. That wouldn't be fair.
No. But you've had some pretty amazing adventures. You saw them when they were, you know, just a local band. At what point did you realize this is going to be the biggest band in the world?
That was the town hall, the civic reception. Liverpool decided to honor them. That was in 1964. It should have been just the parents and the Beatles and, you know, the dignitaries of Liverpool. But they put me down as one of Ringo's family. Yeah. So I managed to wriggle in.
And tell us what happened at that.
What happened was we'd had a meal, and then the 4 lads were just to go out onto the balcony to wave to people. And the town hall has got 2 massive glass doors that you open to go onto the balcony. And when those doors were open, the noise just hit you. And I thought, what's going on here? Everywhere that I looked at was just full of people.
Yeah.
There was about 200,000 people there. It hit me then how big they were. It hadn't really sunk in with me until then.
You also handled the Beatles' really insane volume of fan mail.
Yes.
There's a point in the movie where you fire somebody, also working in the office, because they dared to send a piece of their own hair to one of the Beatles fans who had requested a lock of hair instead of actual Beatles hair. What was so important to you about getting that right? Nobody would have been the wiser. They didn't have DNA tests back then.
I knew. I found out. You know, I didn't want to fool anybody or send false things out. I know it wasn't bad, but it was bad to me.
Frida has 2 very distinct parts to her personality. I've experienced this as a filmmaker working with her, a very charming, sweet side, but she can be really tough when she needs to be. And I have to say that's one of the reasons I think she lasted so long with the Beatles. She was one of their longest serving employees. You know, John Lennon fired her, but she got John Lennon down on his hands and knees and begged her to come back. I don't think many people have gotten John Lennon down on his hands and knees. And for a 17-year-old girl, she had a tough side that could stick up to people when she needed to.
I do come over very hard, don't I?
No, you don't. It's like,
when I see it, I think, oh, was I really that hard?
You're lovably tough. You're like the drill sergeant that you come to respect.
Yeah. Or else.
When I describe to people how much access you had and how tight you were with the band, I always say this woman was on the Magical Mystery Tour. You were literally on the bus.
Yeah, well, I did try and hide, you know. I didn't like getting my photograph taken, but there is the odd shot of me, you know, on the bus.
It's pretty hard to hide away from cameras when you're hanging out with the Beatles.
I know. But, you know, I should have been there for 2 weeks, and I gave a week up because I'd had enough of the madness after a week. So how do you tell a Beatle fan that, you know, do you want to be with the Beatles for 2 weeks? No, thanks. I'll just have 1 week.
What did you leave for? What was more pressing to you?
Work. For that week, I was still subconscious about the mail coming in and the work not getting done.
In the film, you say that when the Beatles broke up, you gave away most of your memorabilia. Of the items you kept, what is maybe the most precious to you?
what I would call the lifelines. What they are is, you know, people were writing in saying, you know, how tall are they? What's the colour of their eyes? What car do they drive? What do they like to eat? So instead of me having to type all that, I typed the questions down and I asked them to fill in the answers.
The Beatles?
Yeah. And I've got the four originals in the bank.
In a vault?
Yeah. They're very precious.
Sure. That's going to pay for a lot of grandkids' education.
Well, funny enough, that's what it's aimed for.
Really?
My grandson's future education. If he goes to university, I don't want him coming out with a debt.
Do you still see the Beatles? They appear in the movie. They love you, obviously.
No, I've been to the odd concert, but I don't keep in contact with them.
Why not?
Would you keep in contact with your employer? You know, I can't just knock on the door and say, you know, hello, I used to work for you 40 years ago. Can I have a free ticket? I wouldn't do that.
But it's more than that. At this point, there's so few people from that era that are probably still around. You're like part of the original inner circle.
And there's not many of us left. You know, I think I'm one of the few that's left, only because I was one of the youngest.
That's what I'm saying. That's the benefit of being a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Frida Kelly, along with filmmaker Ryan White. His documentary about her, Good Old Frida, is on iTunes and in select theaters now.
And Brendan, I have to tell you, Ryan, he was not kidding about Frida being very private.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she told me maybe a few dozen people in her whole town know that she spent a decade with the biggest band that ever was.
That is crazy to think about. I would change my name to Brendan Francis, former Beatles Secretary Newnham.
You'd need a huge driver's license.
Totally worth it.
To eavesdrop.
Jonathan Lethem's writing encompasses novels, essays, and music criticism. 13 years after publishing the award-winning book Motherless Brooklyn, he's released a novel set in Queens and beyond. Today we overhear an excerpt.
Hi, this is Jonathan Lethem. My new book is Dissident Gardens, and this is a passage from it in which Rose Zimmer, newly married to her husband Albert, is being dragged out to New Jersey. These two are a couple of communists, and they're trying to start a family. And she's a very urban lady who wants no part of what he has in mind. This is how Rose Zimmer came to live her long decades in Sunnyside Gardens. It was instead of a Jew farm in New Jersey. Her brand new husband was two husbands, a Jew and a German. The Jew in him wanted cities. The German wanted forests. The German wanted a farm. The German in him who knew only urbanity and culture, who encountered his first and defining jolt of Marx as one of the appetites of the parlor, served forth with tea and cakes and intellectual conversation, this German part of him now wanted chickens. Would clean chicken collect chicken eggs, strangle chicken necks when needed. Thus, Rose Nay Angrish, newly Rose Zimmer, found herself riding south beyond all known civilization into the wilds outside Newark to consider taking up a plot of land in what was called the Jersey Homesteads. He'd unveiled the trip quite suddenly, saying vaguely that there were some people there he had to talk to, and adding, as if it were nothing, that he wanted her to weigh it as a future home for their family. If, she said, if you pilot your tractor in the same manner as you're keeping us on this turnpike, your, what are they called, furrows? Your furrows, Farmer Zimmer, will come out for cocked, and your string beans will all resemble lightning bolts. Do you realize? Please, Rose. The Jersey homesteads, something that couldn't be, but was. It happened under the leadership of a crazed utopian named Benjamin Brown, a Russian-born little Stalin, the newspapers had called him, a shtetl man with a vision, that of wishing to lead tenement Jews out of tenements and back to the soil. As dubious a plan as Hitler's Madagascar, probably, but Brown had managed it. Voila, the future. Dust for 5 months, snow for three, mud for four. Only a city Jew could want farms, she wanted to scream. Those with villages in their blood knew the depths of ignorance, the suffocating stupidity of the life of the countryside. Only those with the villages still in their blood could understand that the future for persons of the book was in the cities. This could be an answer for us, Rose. You know, three wouldn't fit in my flat. Three live in flats all the time, she said. My parents' flat held six. What she didn't add was that babies weren't raised in flats. They were raised in blocks of flats. Babies were dropped at upstairs apartments for an hour, or for 3 or 4 hours. Babies, to Rose's understanding, thrived on a density of other babies and their mothers, in rooms streaming with aunts and cousins, kitchens blazing with arguments drowning the radio. Who'd teach you to boil a diaper on a farm in New Jersey? Or boil it for you? The city at their back, the trees whistled past, a leaf tunnel into incomprehension and fantasy. You want to discover the new world, Albert, you should have a bigger map than gets you only to New Jersey. What's wrong with New Jersey? He said. The teeming millions come to New York. They either have the sense to stay put in the greatest city on earth, or the raw stupidity and courage to go in covered wagons and stake out an Eden of the far horizon, someplace with an Indian name, Dakota or Oklahoma. To turn your back on New York City yet only go as far as New Jersey suggests, as they say, an impoverishment of the imagination. Rose found again she had opened her mouth and couldn't quit. After that first year of marriage, it turned out her silence had an expiration date, like a package of butter. She couldn't be stopped. From the day Rose learned to read and converse, she'd been assembling the vocabulary with which to animate her own mother's attitudes with lashings of the English tongue. And on finding herself at a communist meeting, where the new kind of argumentation was being enacted, Rose's voice was catalyzed. History had commanded she exist. And marriage was itself, she discovered after a year of foolish, fearful silence, a highly dialectical situation.
Jonathan Lethem reading from his just-released novel, Dissident Gardens, and you're listening to The Dinner Party Download from American Public Media.
And now it's time for the main course, where we talk about our favorite part of a dinner party, the food.
So, Rico, I finally met someone who has a better job than us.
Jean-Luc Picard.
No.
Right?
No, this guy doesn't wear pajamas for a living. Oh. His name is Andrew Knowlton. He actually exists, and he is the restaurant editor for Bon Appetit magazine.
That's a plus.
And for their recent issue, he went on a 120-day, 22-state tour of the country's best new restaurants.
Mm. Downside, though, if he has a bad day on the job, no one feels sorry for him at all.
Absolutely no one. He put together a top 10 list of his favorite restaurants, but okay. I was more interested in some restaurant trends he'd noticed. So I met up with him to hear what's new in dining from bar to bathroom.
When you sit down at the bar, you know, a few years ago, it was all about ye old Americana tavern where everything was this wood.
Yeah.
The old.
I have a theory there's no more, there's no wood to reclaim in all of the United States.
Vermont is basically, there's no barns left in Vermont.
It's like a desert right now.
So now we're going very Venetian in a way. It's just all marble. I would say, I don't know, 60% of the bars that I sat at were marble and very clean, classic lines. It feels like you're in Italy at some amazing hotel bar. And then with that old tavern, the wood look, you had the Edison light bulbs, which are, you can
That's
see
right,
the
those kind of dim orangey glow.
Right, and you can see right through them. And they're beautiful, but they obviously got abused. and so now it's more of the pendant lighting, which is kind of just very simple, almost something you would buy at an IKEA or something. It hangs on the electrical line. Those were kind of everywhere this year.
All right, so you're at the bar and you're going to order a drink. You said the PBR can.
PBR can's
gone
done.
The way of the
Thank God. I've been waiting
that
for that.
That
day.
Was an awful era.
So it's two things. It's like large format bottles, and that goes for both wine and beer. And
so we're talking Magnums.
We're talking Magnums and Jeroboams and all these old biblical names. Methuselahs.
Jeroboam is a thing.
A Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah. So large format. And then the curious thing is the huge 32 and 40-ounce bottles of beer that are popping up.
For an individual.
For an individual. And usually it's the best deal. And if you're eating like tacos, it makes sense. But you're ordering it at some restaurant, charging $25 for an entree, and you're having a 40-ounce of Pacifico. So I think it's making it just much more casual. Like, you know, fine dining 15, or just dining 15 years ago, you never would have seen that.
All right, so you've had some drinks. Now let's go to some of the food you've been seeing. The first image in this issue of Bon Appetit in this trend section is a fish head. It's the last frontier.
It's kind of what was going on with pig a few years ago, using every part. Now they're using the collar of fish, the head,
Which is actually really tasty.
Oh, it's delicious. But, yeah. I mean, you pick up a head and you eat it like it's a rib, and it's delicious.
Yeah.
And it's something, look, it's an economical way. They're usually throwing away the heads or using it for a stock. Now they can charge us. But it's delicious. I mean, the one that we, is Chez Sardine in New York, they do a maple miso salmon head, yeah, which is amazing.
All right. And so also, you mentioned pork, which has been king for a while. You did see Calabrian pork paste.
Yes, Andouille. It's kind of the root, you've heard of Andouille.
Yeah, the sausage.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think it kind of came from that.
It's like the filling.
Okay. So it's kind of the filling. But in southern Italy, it's this paste that they make, almost like you would get rillettes or chicken liver in a jar, and really spicy Calabrian chilies in it, and just spread it on toast. And traditionally, it's made with kidneys, but thankfully, they're leaving it out. Kidneys is the one food that I will not eat, so they've left that out.
Why won't you eat kidneys?
I think it's partly because my dad is a nephrologist, which is a kidney doctor, but it's also like it tastes like urine to me. There's something about the texture.
That's psychosomatic, though. I mean, there's a really,
I don't know. There's some deep.
You're like, I'm not going to find out either.
I'm not going to find
out. That's just how it is. All right, so you write a little bit about this. What trends are you seeing in America's restaurant bathrooms?
Yeah, I spent more time in bathrooms at restaurants this year than I care to admit, and not for the reason that you're probably thinking.
It's a little personal.
Not for the reason you're thinking, only because of the design. It used to be kind of this throwaway thought, but now from one place to the next, it was, you would just walk in and be like, this is the coolest bathroom I've ever been in. From like amazing soap, yeah, that was developed for them by some, yeah, you know, Amish soap maker.
So you're seeing better soaps.
Better soaps.
Unisex bathrooms.
Unisex, yeah, bathrooms, you know, separate stalls, yeah, but we all wash our, yeah, hands.
Well, that'll be next
year,
maybe.
That'll be next year. And then the other thing that's cool is they have a different soundtrack in bathrooms, because a lot of times you're kind of in the groove of eating, you're listening to music, yeah, whatever, you're having a conversation. Then you go to this brightly lit room and it's kind of a buzzkill and there's no music. And it's kind of this continuation of the restaurant, yeah, experience.
I just saw my future, man. Bathroom DJ.
Bathroom DJ. There you go.
That'd be amazing. That's
You'd
like
have
niche.
Rougher nights than others, I'm sure.
That's a kind of a niche job. I feel like I could own that space.
Let me know how that goes.
That's right.
So I think the whole bathroom thing is just a continuation of the kind of emphasis that chef and restaurateurs are putting on the dining experience now. There was a few years there that we kind of stuck it to the customer. Like, it was kind of, I'm the chef and you're going to sit on this log in the forest and I'm going to charge $150 for it.
Yeah.
Both chefs and customers kind of like, okay, this is kind of silly.
Yeah, like, wait a second, we're giving you hundreds of dollars.
Yes. So let's bring back the creature comforts of dining out. And I think we're seeing that in dining in America this year.
So, Rico, as you know, before we tape an interview, we test the microphones by having our guests tell us what they had for breakfast.
Right, of course.
So Andrew's answer was nothing.
What?
He said after basically eating the entire country, well, yeah, he's on a strict diet.
That's understandable. Just a Jeroboam of green tea for him a day.
Yeah,
that's
actually enough. Just an Ezekiel of lemon water.
Something biblical.
Yeah. Folks, coming up, your behavior shall be judged by Miss Manners herself.
Mind your P's and Q's when the dinner party download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Newnham, and we are positively tickled to have you joining us.
Tickled.
In a few minutes, we'll speak with members of British indie rock band Alt-J, and we'll also hear from some of you.
Yes, and speaking of you, it's time to solve all of your etiquette dilemmas.
Each week, you send in your questions about how to behave, and here to answer them this week is Miss Manners. Literally.
Yes.
The real Miss Manners. Her real name is Judith Martin. But since 1978, she's written an advice column under the name Miss Manners. It appears 3 times a week in 200 newspapers worldwide. Mm. And she has a new book out called Miss Manners Minds Your Business. It is an etiquette guide for surviving the workplace. And Judith, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Or actually, would it be more polite to call you Miss Manners? How should, yeah, we do
either
this?
Either one. I answer to either one.
Did you ever think about maybe legally changing your last name to Manners?
Certainly
you could
not.
Be?
And have my spend the rest of my life with people telling me they're afraid to eat in front of me and things like that. No.
Well, this is actually leads nicely into our first question. I'm sure you get this question a lot, but we can't resist. What is your most common etiquette lapse? Because I'm sure you're not a perfect human being.
I'm sorry to say I am, and admitting that may be construed food in itself as a lapse. But I'm trying to answer your questions, and I have to confess that I do not have etiquette lapses.
Is immodesty impolite?
It's not charming, and I would have avoided it if I could possibly think of something that I had ever done wrong.
All right. Well, you say it in such a charming way, I think it works out.
You win.
Well, look, let's talk about your book for a moment, which focuses primarily on business. What's the most common etiquette question you get from readers as it relates to the workplace?
Well, as you know, the workplace has gotten very volatile. People are upset by the other people with whom they work. And their chief problem seems to be that there is a confusion between the personal life and the work life. When you asked me just now if I would want to change my name to Manners, that would mean that I would have only a professional identity. And that's what most people are doing nowadays. And it's a huge mistake. We've seen this peculiar reversal where people use social manners at business and business manners in their social lives. On the job, they're giving baby showers and exchanging presents at Christmas celebrating birthdays, hanging out after work. In their private lives, they're, as I say, using business manners. You want to fall in love, you take out an ad, and then you run interviews as tersely as you can. And if you see a possible prospect, you put them on to an internship for a while to see if it'll work out, and so on. And I have even had letters from people who told me their relatives were charging them for Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. So what is your advice? How do we break out of this cycle?
Well, it's, of course, context specific. What is the situation? But generally, have a private life and a professional life.
Yeah, well, I've worked with Rico for years, and he doesn't know my real telephone number. So
good for you.
And that's right.
He just found that out.
He can't call you in the middle of the night.
Yes.
All right, look, while our listeners have submitted some questions for you, some of them relate to the workplace, others don't. So let's begin.
We're going to start with a question from Ile, I believe it's pronounced. She contacted us via Facebook, and she says, "I adore some of my workmates and find others irritating to no end. How do I engage in activities with the coworkers I do enjoy without alienating the ones I don't like? Note the undesired coworkers are overly zealous to hang out and they are upset when they are not included." So this is getting right to your point right here.
Yes. And I'm assuming the activities and the hanging out are not another way of saying work.
Right.
You have to work with them whether you like them or not.
I can't fire my coworkers? What's wrong with this world?
The one thing is, don't stand in the middle of the office and say, oh, let's all go out for drinks, and then say you and not you.
Yeah.
Keep it private. And don't post it on Facebook, and don't make a general announcement. You quietly arrange to meet the people you like on your own time.
But what happens if one of the other coworkers says, what are you doing after work? And they're like, oh, I'm going to go out with Rico and Brendan.
No,
and
you
that person says, why don't I get to hang out with those cool dudes?
Oh,
that's not fair.
You say, I'm going to hang out with these people. You say, I'm busy.
So in a way, you're kind of being secretive. Don't let them know where you're going.
It's being discreet.
Yes, discretion. A lost art, by the way, in many respects. There was always a rule that you don't discuss social events in front of people who are not invited. This has been totally demolished by people posting their social events online for everybody to know. Not a good idea, because people do resent being left out. So you make your arrangements discreetly.
And also, you could wear disguises if you're going somewhere nearby.
You could wear a paper bag over your head, yes. But it's very hard to drink with a paper bag over your head.
All right, so we have another question. This one comes from Matthew. He sent it to us via Facebook. Matthew writes, I have a question for Miss Manners. Perfect, Matthew. I've recently started an internship, and instead of providing me with a computer, they've asked that I bring in my own laptop and have them download all of their stuff onto it. Mm. This is a big company, so it's not like they can't afford to give me a computer. Is there a polite and professional way to tell them that I don't feel comfortable with them taking over my computer for a temporary internship?
Unless this person was told that bringing a laptop is part of the job,
I very much sympathize with the fact that he doesn't want to use it. But he's not in a very strong position as an intern. I think what I would do is say, you know, I use my personal laptop for a lot of different things, and I can't guarantee that everything concerning work would be kept confidential.
Mm.
And that ought to scare them.
Yeah. But Miss Manners, that is a bit of a lie. You could say that to maybe get them to
give
you a computer.
Not a lie at all. Everything that goes on a computer, you know this, is going to be available to somebody.
But if he just uses that...
He's using that as an excuse. He really just doesn't want to do it because he doesn't like
it. Yes. In the etiquette business, we don't use that term lie the way you do. There are ways of saying things that spare people's feelings, that are effective and so on, gentle ways of saying things that are extremely valuable.
So I've learned today that I can be immodest, I can lie,
and I shouldn't correct people. Come on.
All right. This has been real education.
You have not learned those things from me.
We know. Here's a last question, and actually this is from us. Regular listeners to the show know that we often have Lizzie and Daniel from the Emily Post Institute here to answer etiquette questions.
They're the great-great-grandkids of Emily Post.
That is right. And our question is it impolite to be having you on our show?
Should we be loyal to the Post?
Yes.
I'm sure that in the etiquette business, we do not have those kinds of rivalries.
Really?
We
don't
recognize that there's a tremendous etiquette crisis going on, mm-hmm. and the more of us who pitch in, the better.
So you're like an army, basically. All together, you form an army of politeness.
Except we're very poorly armed.
So you guys aren't rival gangs. You don't have really polite duels on occasion?
Rumbles?
Certainly not. We're all working for the same cause.
Okay, that makes us feel better. Miss Manners, thank you for fighting the good fight and for telling our audience how to behave.
Well, I'm delighted to have been here.
Enrico, it just occurred to me that actually Miss Manners probably seeks advice from the Post and vice versa, you know, because who else can they turn to? Right?
That is true. But what happened, you know, what if neither of them has the answer? What happens?
They probably write the Dear Abby under a fake name.
There you are. Or in the case of Miss Manners, she writes in with her actual name.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Folks, you can send us questions using whatever name you want. You just head to dinnerpartydownload.org and click contact.
Our guests of honor this week are Gwil Sainsbury and Gus Unger Hamilton. They are the guitarist and keyboard player for the UK band Alt-J. They are touring the USA now, playing tunes from their debut album, An Awesome Wave, which last winter won them the prestigious Mercury Prize. And here is a clip from their song, Breeze Blocks.
She bruises calls, she splatters pistol shots, hold her down with soggy clothes and breeze blocks. She's morphine, queen of my vaccine, my love, my love.
So the album was a top 20 hit around the world. The video for Breeze Blocks now has close to 17 million hits on YouTube. And this is for what is not what you would call top 40 music. It's full of tempo changes. The lyrics are cryptic. Even the video is kind of unsettling, actually. Were you expecting this material to be embraced like this?
I think we always thought that what we were doing was kind of worthwhile, and we really enjoyed the music we were making and listening to what we'd just made. It was satisfying. And, you know, I think there was a hope that it would reach people in the way it has, but I don't think I ever seriously thought it would.
What was maybe a moment where you took a step back and realized, wow, this is really happening?
I think doing our first BBC live session was really, really exciting. But then again, a lot of bands, you know, small bands do them and don't have much success after that. But I think certainly that was a time where we were like, wow, this is a big deal. We can say we've been to Maida Vale, the famous BBC studios, and done that. And that was about August 2011.
Was it? Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And that's actually quite a long time ago, so I don't know. It's hard to pinpoint one real time.
Well, actually, speaking of your early days, that one of the sort of rumors flying around is that your sound evolved because you had to play very quietly in your dorm room at university. Is that correct?
Yeah, this refers to Tom, our drummer, not being able to use cymbals. He basically had a kick, a snare, and a saucepan that he strapped to his leg with the cord of my dressing gown, because you couldn't have cymbals, you couldn't have massive toms, because it was just, it was loud enough.
He only used brushes as well, yeah, he didn't use sticks.
Yeah. You just kind of retained a certain flavour of that?
I think we did it, we did that for 2 or 3 years while we were at university. That was our rehearsal environment, so it was, that's just how it's turned out. I think it's a good thing, you know, it's really nice to have a minimal kit, because it lets a lot of other parts breathe. As soon as you put a big crash cymbal on it, there's a lot of room taken up.
But I also have to say, having played in bands with a lot of drummers very often want to crush, they didn't get into drums to not hit things. Yeah. I can imagine this moment of release when finally you're out of the dorm room and you get to bang on something.
Tom does hit the drums extremely hard now, I would say, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we'll do a sound check where our guitar tech and drum tech set all our levels, our instruments for us. And when Tom actually starts playing, it's so loud, it makes me feel physically sick sometimes.
The drum tech underestimates the ferocity with which Tom is going to attack the drums.
Yeah.
All right, we have two questions that we ask everybody on the show. Our first question is, if we were to meet you at a dinner party, what question should we not ask you? The question you're tired of being asked.
Why do you love triangles so much? What, tell us about triangles. Anything about triangles.
That is not what I expected. For those who don't know, Alt-J is the keyboard stroke that creates a triangle on a computer screen, correct?
Yeah, and we also have this lyric, triangles are my favorite shape. I'm not helping myself here, but we also say triangles are my favorite shape in Tessellate.
Tessellate being the name of one of your songs. I won't ask you that question.
Yeah, the main response being that we don't really care about triangles that much.
It was a phase.
It's a phase.
All right, and our second question is, tell us something we don't know. It's less a question than an order, and it can be about anything you like. It can be about yourself, a piece of trivia, something that'll blow people's minds at a party.
Blow their minds at a party? Oh no, I don't know if this will do that. It was just something quite funny that no one knows about the band, and that's that we call our tour manager Nan.
Nan? As in Nan Bread?
As in Nanny. As in Nana. As in like Grandma.
Grandma.
Is this person a woman?
Yeah.
Are they elderly?
No.
She's like 28.
Is this because you are very young, or is it because she acts like she is quite old?
I think it's because we know we can get her to do stuff for us.
I think it started because she used to do nice things for us. Like one time we had some interviews to do and we didn't want to do them, so she made us all like hot drinks. And that was really sweet.
She also, at Christmas, she sent us all a Christmas present that was like a laundry bag with our name on it.
Laundry bag.
We all got our own one for Christmas from her. It's even got a delta on it.
Oh, it's got the triangle on it.
And our names.
Can she work for me?
No, she's ours.
There needs to be an agency that has band nannies.
Yeah.
That could be the name of the agency.
That'd be great.
Gus Unger-Hamilton and Will Sainsbury of the band Alt-J. You are listening to their lovely tune, Something Good. And if you're lucky, they may play it for you when you catch them on their U.S. tour, which is happening right now.
Speaking of which, how come we don't have a tour manager?
That's a good question. I would love a public radio nanny.
Exactly. You know? To make us hot drinks when we don't want to do an interview.
Actually, I think that's called an intern, now that I think about it.
48,000
All right, and now it's time for your letters, because yes, we do occasionally make mistakes, you know.
Indeed, or at least express ideas that are debatable. And few ideas we have aired have provoked as much heated debate as that all-important, world-shaking topic of, yes, spacing after periods.
That's right. You may recall a few weeks back, our etiquette guest, Corey Sika, writer and editor of culture website The All, said the following.
I get a lot of writers turning in things with double spaces. And I'm like, oh, did you learn on a typewriter? This is an old thing from typewriters, right?
Really? I double space.
You're a sick old pervert.
Thank you. Cut.
So several listeners rose to Rico's defense, like Jasper from Minneapolis.
What? Single spacing after a period? Give me a break. Of course you double space. It gives the writing flow, which makes it more inviting and compelling to read.
Thank you, Jasper. But alas, fellow double spacers, I must defer to our digital intern, Brittany, the woman who polices the copy on our website with an iron fist, by the way, who insisted,
a double space is a portal to the dark ages. I will not walk through that door, ever.
Single space, Rico, I told you so.
You've all betrayed me.
Moving on, recently science writer Mary Roach told us a few interesting facts about the digestive tract.
Yep.
Mary mentioned experiments that were performed on Alexis St. Martin, an otherwise normal guy, with a hole in his stomach.
Fun.
An anecdote that triggered this supernatural event.
Hey guys, this is Emma from Arden, Delaware, and I know this may sound weird, But recently on your show, there was a story about Alexis St. Martin who had a hole in his stomach. Now, the weird part is, as I was listening to your show, I was leafing through an old sketchbook, and I came to a page of a sketch of a woman clutching a hole that went right through her middle. Now, there was a random Catholic saint candle on the bedside table, and when I went to go blow it out, I noticed the saint on it was St. Martin. So you try explaining that one.
All right, Brendan, any theories?
Cumin always gives me weird dreams.
That is totally legitimate. Also, on a practical note, Emma, if you've been inviting demons into your house, just stop doing that.
Yeah, that's just good advice for anybody,
I'd say.
And here's our final letter. Last week, we told you the story of the Cold War hotline between D.C. and Moscow, and that despite popular belief, it does not involve a red telephone. Well, conspiracy theorists, here you go.
Hi, my name is John Mullen from Bothell, Washington. And just a week and a half earlier, I had been visiting with a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in 20 years who works in Washington, D.C. And I was asking where he works. He said, at the Pentagon. In fact, my desk is right across the hall from the red phone. Yes, that red phone. So, according to my buddy, who is an Eagle Scout, it is not a myth.
Well, John, we did some research, and it is possible the red phone line that your pal is talking about runs between the Pentagon and other places within our government and not Russia. Or your friend may be right, in which case you won't be seeing him for 20 years because the government now knows he leaked classified information.
Nice work, John.
Sweet.
Folks, if you have a correction or just want to have your friend detained, you can drop us a line or call our hotline. It is the phone in my cubicle. It's definitely real, and the number is 213-621-3554.
And that's the Dinner Party Download for this week. Jackson Musker is our assistant producer. James Delahousie, Davey Kim, and Brittany Martin are our nannies.
Aww.
Peter Clowney is our executive producer.
Chris Clark provided engineering assistance. If you like what you hear, head to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. There you'll find all of our past episodes for the price of free.
And you can also hear from us for free on Facebook or on Twitter, where we are Dinner Party DNLD.
Thanks for listening. Bon appétit.